your travels now, the places you have been to and the places you might hope to get to, please.
Well, I think I mentioned to you that during the war, I traveled overseas to Asia, and I came back across the Middle East, and we were at a point back there, it seems hours ago, in which I mentioned when I came back across the Middle East from China on the Crescent, which was a special flight, I was in Cairo, and it was that first time that the Zionist ideal, which to me was theoretical from books that I read and songs that I sang here, that the realities came across up short. Samir Suki, who was the UP representative in Cairo, had a special little dinner party. His wife, who was a beautiful Egyptian, made typically Middle Eastern food, fig leaves and so on and so forth, and with fruits and vegetables, so I would be safe to eat it. She understood. She was not Jewish. And the then ambassador from Lebanon was there. And Samir Suki was pretty keen reporter, and he was talking about Zionism and a Jewish state. And this was, remember, in 44, 45, somewhere around there, before 47, before UNSCOP and the partition plan. And it was very amiable around the dinner table. The food was absolutely delicious and exotic, and I could eat it because it was all vegetable stuff, fruits. And the ambassador from Lebanon said, if I can tell you, my friends, I'm paraphrasing that, I don't remember that. I can tell you, my friends, if the Jewish state is ever declared today, there will be war tomorrow. And Samir Suki gave me a look to see if I would answer. I just kept quiet. But it was embedded in my mind. And if anybody could make that kind of a threat from Lebanon, which was not one of the greatest Arab leaders, although, and was very commercially minded besides, and would not like a war to disrupt their money-making. After all, the Lebanese are descended from the fifth Phoenicians, which are the great traders. Trader, T-R-A-D-E-R-S. And it sunk in my memory, and I knew that there would be trouble ahead in our lifetime. And I was going to bring up to date the war room of the American headquarters in Cairo, and I had it. They wanted to fly me into Tel Aviv that time, which is only a British mandatory territory there, and because so many British soldiers, when they were on leave, they would go to Tel Aviv because that would be the most Western kind of, the girls were prettier there and would dance with them and so on and so forth. Anyway, I was ready to fly in. I thought that was just a wonderful opportunity. I go to see this, you know, something I've been only reading about since I was a kid. And my parents talked to me about Zionism, Herzl. And here I was going to see something that was in fruition. And I knew things were going to happen. I didn't know what was going to happen. And one of the officers told me that, he says, you're on special orders. He says, if you weren't on special orders, we could do it. But I want you to know, if you fly into Tel Aviv, you will be going contrary to your orders, which gives you a priority to move from China to the United States. And if you divert and something happens, you won't be following orders. You'll be breaking your orders. If I was going to go to Las Vegas or something like that, I wouldn't mind. But I was just concerned that if something would happen, I, a Jewish officer, diverting my trip to go into Tel Aviv under special orders, I just was a little uncomfortable that might happen. So I denied myself that great opportunity. It hurt me to do that. Mm-hmm. But I denied myself because I didn't want anybody saying anything wrong. Obviously, everybody knew who I was and what I was, you can see from what I told you before. So I denied myself of seeing Tel Aviv before the the State of Israel, mm-hmm. Came into being. So it took me until 1957. It took me about 10 years before, over 10 years before I got back to see nascent Israel. Mm-hmm. I feel badly about that to this day. That you know, it was, you know, it was so near yet so far, you know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that was my introduction to the Middle East. And we went to Iran, to Turkey, and I flew to what became Tunisia, Algeria, etc. So I was familiar with Asia. I was familiar with the which is properly called West Asia. You know, to call it the Near East is an insult. Near from where? Near from the West. The Asian geographers call it the Far East, or East Asia and West Asia. It's only when you're in London do you say the Near East, near to here, not near to there. So you have to watch your sensitivities. Just like when you go to dinner with an Arab, you never, with Arabs or Muslims, you never reach for food with your left hand. You always reach with your right hand, because the left hand is usually used for personal mm-hmm. things, yeah. And you don't use your right hand. I don't have to tell you, they don't have perfect bathrooms in Asia. However, speaking about foods, you might be interested to know, we've talked about the dinner with Samer Suki. When President Reagan just went to China, if you mention they talk about him drinking toasts, mm-hmm. and they used the term Mao Tai. I'm sure 99% of people don't know what Mao Tai. Mao Tai is their, it's like white fire. And you drink your toasts in either a full drink or a half drink. It's either shui bian or shui liao, either full or as you wish. And when you're eating in China, very often there are plates in the center, and with your chopsticks, it'd be the height of courtesy to have your chopsticks and dip it into a succulent piece of whatever it is with your chopsticks that you've been eating with, and put it into your friend's plate. That's a great courtesy. And he would do the same for you. And you don't dare not eat it, because it's an insult.
Customs.
The customs change.
Yeah.
How many times did you go to Israel?
I've been to Israel? I lost count.
Many times.
Somewhere around 20.
I see. Oh, my. More than several.
But now, for the first time, God willing, we'll go this summer. For the first time, I'll be able to go where I wouldn't have to blow in and run through a series of interviews and travel and spend Shabbos with the kids and race home again. This time, we're going to go with an open-ended visit for the first time. And we're thinking of it with great pleasure. Yeah. We have an apartment now in Jerusalem. It's only bare walls. So we're going from a 12-room house to try to find a way to survey whether we can live in a 3-room apartment.
Would you think about going to Israel to live?
That's our aim. As I said, Evelyn mentioned we have 65% of our family there.
Yes.
What she's doing is adding up the family. We hope that eventually they'll all be there.
I see.
God willing. You know, one never knows about these things. Doctors don't have an easy time in Israel, you know. They have to set up their systems differently. And I don't know about lawyers either. But we all hope that we can make our home in Israel and help build the Jewish state. And it's a tribute to our kids that they are not putting golf courses, fancy houses and Cadillacs at the top of their agenda, but rather upbuilding the state of Israel. We're proud of them for that.
Tribute to you, too, may I say.
Well, tribute to Evelyn.
I'd like to ask you also how you view your accomplishments, your successes and or any failures you might have thought of.
Well, I attributed both whatever successes I have, small though they be, and whatever failures I have, great though they may be, to the fact of what I mentioned to you, that everybody who is Jewish at one time or another should put his talents and his energies at the feet of the Jewish people, one time or another, so that he can earn the merit and the mitzvah of Ahavat Yisrael, the love of Israel. Now, we know that our Jewish people are not perfect, and we know some leave somewhat to be desired, but the Jewish people of a whole is a singular people, not a chosen people, a singular people. That mistranslation has caused us untold agony. They're a singular people. They have a singular mission of usefulness and bringing peace and happiness, consideration, a moral stance to living. And insofar as we can do that, each of us, we are fulfilling that kind of a mission. And we know it's not easy because everybody acknowledges that every man, Jewish or non-Jewish, every woman, Jewish or non-Jewish, has two kinds of pools in his psychology. We call it in Jewish philosophy, a Yetzer Tov and a Yetzer Hara, a good inclination and a wicked inclination. And you have to spend your years balancing those off and hope that the Yetzer Tov, the inclination for good, balances out the negative. And that's what we hope that we've been able to do, to balance out the negative with the positive for the benefit of the Jewish people.
That's wonderful. To get back to something a little more mundane now, how would you contrast Pittsburgh today with Pittsburgh of yesteryear?
You asked for travels. I've been in Europe. I've been in South America. I've been in the Isles of the Atlantic. I was on the island of Masira, which is fly infested and nearly forced down there with a bad motor, and nearly drowned there. I went through Yemen, went through Aden, and when I see that the Jews are coming out of Yemen now, it's like a miracle. You know, they brought them out in the Bible. It talks about the wings of angels. I'll bear you on wings of angels. When the Yemenites came out of Yemen, they quoted the biblical phrase on the wings of eagles because they were on airplanes. So they're flying on the wings of eagles. And they had never seen airplanes, never been in one certainly, and they were out 5 minutes and the stewards threw up their hands because they were building fires in the middle of the airplane to make tea. Anyway, I mentioned that because you asked for travels and now you brought me back to Pittsburgh, so I want to say that Pittsburgh is home. It's a town that gave me wonderful opportunities and wonderful family. Now you wanted me to take it from there, where?
No, I wanted to talk about if you can contrast Pittsburgh today with Pittsburgh of your youth.
When I went away to college from Pittsburgh, I thought I would never return. It was dirty, grimy. I told you some of the Depression period experiences. Mm-hmm. Even close to home, which soured my young feelings. Contrast, I think the sun has brightened over Pittsburgh, literally and figuratively. It's a warm city. People who come here from other cities are truly astonished at the warmth of the people, so it must not be just one or two. There must be many. And it's one of the unique cities in the world because it's the only city in America who has not had the travail of heavy out-migration that put this center city in decay. And there are many reasons for that, I suppose. The river is making segments, the ethnic setup of Pittsburgh, having enclaves of different ethnic groupings, and the hills that block off Community A from Community B. If you know how London is blocked off by voices, you know, their accents, you can see how community is set up. The Jewish community has grown from a very feeble community when I was here. I thought it was pretty feeble. If you take a look at what happened before World War II and the Holocaust and how weak the Jewish community nationally was. Mm-hmm. So little was done to save those Jews. And we're still living with that guilt feeling from could we have done more to save mm-hmm. more people from Europe. And I lived through that, and I saw how feeble the Jewish community was. Organizations that really had no strength, no power. I was going to college in the Father Coghlan days. Mm-hmm. I used to work in the library of a university that used to get Father Coghlan social justice. I used mm-hmm. to file it.
I remember.
I knew how feeble and how quasi-disenfranchised, since I grew up, since I'm a child of the Depression, as I suppose to some extent we all are, except you. We have had experience of knowing how defective the social organization has been. Now,
what do you think of the Jewish life in Pittsburgh now?
I think it has had a. This is the Renaissance city, and the Jewish community has had a Renaissance. It's a Renaissance community. In full, the Jewish community is full of stature, dignity, verve, vitality, and vigor, and it reflects the Jewish community of America at large. It might be proverbial, and it might be foreordained, because where the pre-war Jewish community of America was weak and disunited, the post-war Jewish community, relatively so, is united, and the strongest Jewish community resides in America and has ever existed in the whole history of the Jewish people. And I say this in speeches that I give, who knows but what the Lord Almighty, who we learn from the Talmud, gives you the refuah, the healing, before the makkah, the suffering of the plague. Who knows but what the refuah of, since 1623, the American Jewish community was built up from those 17th century, when those 23 people landed in New York to start the Jewish community, who knows but what that was the beginning of a divine plan to have the strongest Jewish community ever start to be built up. And it must give us pause, because we're a people, we're a people of history, to understand that that now when the state of Israel is reborn and needs strength of economic, political, etc., who knows but what that was not foreordained over 300 years ago to start its development to this our very day.
Frank, that was more than inspirational, I say, and I thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to add? I think our questions are just about at an end, unless you have anything else to add.
I've been sitting on one. If you get
fine.
Another chance. This is way off the mark. It's something I've been wanting to ask someone of your stature. As a newspaper man, how do you feel about Israel and the way it handles its public relations? The way seems the whole world is negative about Israel. And how do you feel about their response to world opinion, to what they read about them and hear about themselves?
Well, that's a big question. At least takes a trilogy.
I'll bet.
The state of Israel is a sovereign nation. The most amazing development in Jewish history. Never in anybody's history has a people exiled from its mother country ever rise again from the ashes like a phoenix to full sovereignty. One of the most amazing developments that we don't appreciate ourselves, and the world certainly doesn't appreciate it. No country in the world, no people in the world has ever resurrected its language from the depths mm-hmm. to make it a language of communication. Has never been done. Not even Ireland. No country's ever done this. All the great empires in the world lay in the dust of antiquity. We only arise to tell our story again and again and again. We happen to be the best psychologically oriented people for explanatory language in history. So I wouldn't worry about how Israel responds to PR. PR is not the alpha and omega. Besides, there are a lot of people who have an interest in the world of degrading Israel. Israel certainly has to tell its story, but we've been explaining ourselves for over 3,000 years. It's strange that we're not having very much success with the world, but the world has been a very hostile world. And if the world would be an objective, honest, truthful world, and fair, maybe we would have less difficulty. So my guess is that the fault lay not so much in Israel or those who guided or those who supported Israel, although everybody has his faults. But my guess is part and parcel of the fault lay elsewhere with malicious intent, because there are a lot of people in this world who don't want Israel to succeed for a lot of reasons. Both religious, sociological, theological, and commercial. There's an awful lot of hatred that the Jews called sinas chinam. It's causeless hatred. And there are a lot of causeless hatred. Why else do people say the Jews do this and the Jews do that and Jews have this characteristic? And we Jews foolishly try to occupy chukat ha-goyim, the rules of the goyim. If it's fashionable to do this, we do that. If it's fashionable not to have children, we have less children than anybody. We're giving Hitler a last laugh. We're now down below ZPG in the world. There's zero population growth minus among the Jewish people. After we lost 6 million, how foolish can you be? How foolish can you be to have something like 30 to 50% intermarriage? No families left untouched. I didn't say that, that this family is better than that. No families left untouched. But it doesn't make any sense for us to ruin ourselves and give Hitler the last laugh. We are not producing ourselves. And these are the ideas that have to be developed. And creative survival, not survival, but creative survival.
I appreciate that answer.
Mr. Bloom, is there anything else now that you would like to add to this interview before we finish?
Well, since we've only been going a couple seconds, I guess I collect my,
I really know you.
My thoughts. I do want to thank the National Council of Jewish Women for this opportunity. They've been wonderful to me from the time I was a little boy. And I thank them for a great many opportunities, including this one, and not only this one itself, but also the people they sent to me as representatives to this.
Thank you very much. It's very kind of you. It's been a wonderful interview, and we're very much enriched for having done it. Thank you again.
And I want to put my thanks in, too. It's been a wonderful experience in my life, believe me.
Thank you. You're very sweet, Cecil.